Welcome, everybody, to Different Thinking for Different Times. And I'm your host, Steve Lentini. And I'm grateful today to have a guest that I find so fascinating, all the different things he's doing and his point of view. It's in alignment with what I talk about, which is expanding our thinking from small-minded acorn brain thinking learned in caveman times to infinite thinking. Modeling what we live in, an infinite universe that, you know, we even define it as humans, as a universe to give a definition. It's beyond comprehension. So with that, I want to welcome my guest. I'm going to ask you, how do you say your last name, Ali?
Horiat.
Horiat, that's what I was going to say. All right, should have trusted my gut. So welcome, Ali Horiat, everybody. And I want you first, Ali, to tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, how you came to this, and then we'll go into some of the questions that I have.
Okay. I'll give you the short side of it. I was born in Dubai, did part of my schooling in Dubai, part in Switzerland, moved to Canada for university, did a lot of schooling partly because I enjoyed Toronto as a city. The reason being, when I grew up in Dubai, it was the 1980s. It wasn't today Dubai. So it was very different. And Toronto was this new world for me. And so I did a lot of schooling because I wanted to stay. And then I started working. I couldn't get a job because I was overqualified. I had 3 master's degrees, 2 undergrads, a postgrad. And so nobody would hire me. And I had a little bit of money. So I started, because I traveled a lot when I was younger with my family, I learned a lot about exchanging currency. Basically, you know, every country you went to, and back then there was no euro. So when you went to Europe, it was, you know, Deutschmark, French francs, British pound, so many different currencies. And so I had learned about currency a little bit, and I knew, had a little background. And I thought, you know what, I'll just do some trading on my own on Forex and see how that works. One thing led to another. I did well. A whole bunch of my friends said, hey, you know, can we put some money with you so you could, you know, do the same with our money as well? And I said, sure. I did really well then, so well that one day the equivalent of the FCC there basically turned around and said, hey, you can't do this because it's a big amount of money now. You know, it's in the millions and you're not even registered. And I said, register what? Because I had no clue about the legalities of it. And so I got a lawyer. We registered, it became a fund, an actual fund. When it became a fund, a lot of different opportunities opened. Now I could lend the money legally to institutions and homes and mortgages. And so I really grew into that market. And as we grew, more money came in. And then I had my celebrity moment where I had a whole seasonal streak with no missed calls. So every purchase and sale moment that I had actually hit. Every single time on every trade.
Wow.
And it didn't come as an applause or anything. It came as another, security view as what's going on here, what kind of fraud's going on here, because nobody can do that. And then when they realized, no, it was just a lucky streak, that's all it is, they let me go. And so that was the celebrity moment. And from there, I did really, really well. So well that it upset. I started becoming sadder as a person because I'll tell you, the first million is a lot of joy. The first, you know, Porsche is a lot of joy. The first travel with your own money in first class is a lot of joy. But then just like the concept of diminishing returns in economics, you know, after you give a child their 6th ice cream, they're just going to puke. There's no joy in that 6th one. But the child doesn't know not to eat it anymore. They just eat it and they puke. So yeah. Because, you know, they have this idea, this delusion that ice cream's good no matter what. And so yeah. I was addicted to money, and that was the reality of it. I left. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd take a break and reconsider what I'm doing. And I was always charitable in a sense, but it was the mm-hmm. traditional wealthy people's philanthropic, cool. And it was essentially, mm-hmm. you know, going to these galas and giving money away and things like that. And it was mostly a tax write-off. Mm-hmm. And that was really the most of it. And I'd help friends mm-hmm. here and there. And that was my real charity. My real support was, you know, my circle, my community of people that I would help out financially or even emotionally or give advice or help or support their kids, you know, which school to go to, being that I was, you know, academic for such a long time. When I left, mm-hmm. I started writing some of the books that I've written. I have 13 books. Some of those were written during that span of the first year or two that I was traveling. And when I say traveling, it was, again, just me going, you know, five-star resort to another in exotic places of the world and, you know, writing and thinking I'm going to change the world. That's when I realized, no, I'm addicted to money. And the addiction, I'm carrying around with me. It's like being addicted to heroin and just taking it with you on all your travels. You know, nothing's changing. So I realized I have to give it away. I have to get rid of it. I have to detox. So I had a call with my team, and I decided to give every penny away. I did that. I even my home, everything was gone, to the point where I actually slept in shelters and train stations for a very short period of time. And it wasn't anything scary for me, because I knew I was eventually going to be okay. It's not like a lot of the people whom I know are homeless who don't have that to fall back on. So it wasn't a matter of me experiencing homelessness. It's just, you know, for a short period of time, when I say I gave everything away, it was every penny. And so from that experience, I realized the world outside the ivory tower is a lot harder to repair than from that overview that you have, because that overview is so clouded. You're so high up that there's this huge mist of cloud, and you really don't see the problems. You see the problems that may affect you. And so when you want to fix things, you think of, how do I make this better so that I'm happier or more comfortable, right? And so now I was seeing the world from this new perspective. So that's when it hit me that it's an easy fix, actually. It's a very easy fix. We just have to come together. That's all it is. I mean, it's a big thing to come together, but it's an easy thing at the same time, conceptually or theoretically, because you know, we need money to help the poor, or we need money to help to fix infrastructural issues. Okay, easy. Why can't I get 100 million people to give me $100 each? That's not conceptually difficult, but I mean, it's impossible almost, you know, to realize. And so that's where I kind of got involved in this. And I thought, you know what?
My dogs chimed in with how impossible that is.
Yeah, they're like, no way. That's like way one too many treats. I got to the point where I thought, maybe if I built a space where people felt equally a part of it and equally able to make that change with their support, whether it's financial, whether it's being there, whether it's being part of the collective, this collective can grow large enough to make a difference in the world. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do that. That's where Compassivist was born. And Compassivist basically is a word I put together. It simply means compassionate activist. That's all it means. And compassionate activist really means...
It's pronounced compassion... Compassion... No,
Compassivist.
Yes. I like that.
And I'll tell you about the E at the end in a second too. I think everything has to start with compassion, because, you know, part of compassion is passion. You need to have some kind of emotion to feel for another person or to feel for yourself. So if you're emotionless in this world, it means you're purposeless. It means you have, you bring yourself no value. So the first thing that we have to get straight is value, passion, compassion. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if we hold value within ourselves and we don't share that value and we don't use that value to make a difference or to make improvement, then this value is really valueless, realistically speaking. So it's kind of like, I have $5, I keep it in my pocket. There, you know, a meal costs $1 each. There's four people who are starving. If I don't use that $5 to feed them and myself and they die, that $5 is worthless. There's no value to it. So mm-hmm. action is where the value of compassion comes in. So activist, mm-hmm. you know, the last vist is there. Now, you could say the correct spelling would stop at the T. There's no reason for the E. The E is, you know, from Latin-based, French, Spanish, other languages, the E is for the femininity. I believe mm-hmm. compassion comes from the feminine side of humanity, from feminine mm-hmm. side of the universe, from the feminine mm-hmm. power of Mother Nature, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. to nurture compassion and to nurture dialogue and to nurture understanding and to cultivate this concept of listening to each other, hearing each other, wanting to find common ground with each other, we have to look at all the challenges that we have with a motherly eye and not with the eye of a soldier. So the art of war for me doesn't play into this part because mm-hmm. I'm not looking for a strategy on how to defeat, on how to win, on how to conquer. Machiavelli doesn't play a part here because I'm not looking for overcoming another in an opportunistic manner. What I'm looking mm-hmm. to do is the Jesus way, which is the feminine way, which is basically the motherly way. A mother never looks at, you know, if mothers didn't have that innate love, innate compassion, there would be no living species in the world. Because as soon as the baby comes out, in any, you know, any mother, any species, even from an egg, it hatches, you eat it. It's the easiest meal. Mm-hmm. It's the simplest theory. Mm-hmm. It's the easiest meal. The reason why we grow, and you're here at this age, and I'm here at this age, is because we had a mother who raised us, or a woman, or some kind of feminine power that allowed us to grow, even if we were orphans. Mm-hmm. Some people came together, mm-hmm. used their femininity to nurture us, and we grew.
Sure.
So mm-hmm. the E at the end, to me, is the most important part of the word. It mm-hmm. allows us to put aside gender, to put aside all of these confusing conversations. And, you know, there are people who believe in two genders, there are people who believe in 750 genders, and there's so much confusion going on there. I think the reason is because we don't understand that we can be all. We are the universe. Yeah. There is no, I mean, show me God being a woman or being a man. It doesn't exist. So in a sense, you know, for procreation, we have this biological space that differentiates us. But in our emotionals, it's not like that. I could hug, you know, a child the same way that a woman can hug a child with the same emotion, with the same love, with the same, you know, connectivity together. Mm-hmm. And that is when mm-hmm. I become the feminine force of myself. That is when mm-hmm. my feminine energy flows, right? And so I think mm-hmm. we need today to really hone in on that feminine power all together and be able to create that. And I love what you said earlier about dialogue, because our podcast is called Compassivist Dialogues. And essentially, that's what it is. It's having conversations with people at all levels of life and trying to come to an understanding together, trying to say, okay, if we want to make a difference, should we not first be able to communicate with each other? Should we not be able to spread that love with each other? And if we can, great, we're going to make those differences. And that's the whole story. Yeah. And from there, the construction began. And by construction, I mean, I thought, how do I start this? Where do I go with this? And mm-hmm. I thought the arts. And the reason I thought the arts is because every movement, every change, every revolution, every even, you know, a lot of the biological evolutions that we relate to, because I find we evolve in two ways, but because we're so scientific, we recognize the tangible evolution. So if we lost an eye because it was purposeless, we say, oh, we evolved, that's not there. But when we grow mentally, we don't call it evolution because you can't tangibly catch it. And so we don't recognize it. So I think mm-hmm. our intangible evolution has mm-hmm. shown us that we always start with the arts. And by the arts, I mean by expression. I am unhappy mm-hmm. with my government. I am mm-hmm. unhappy in my marriage or whatever it may be. And so that's where it starts. And so Compassivist is an expressionist artistic movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we hope to bring people together.
Yeah. And then you started the octopus.
Yes. So that's where the octopus came exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell you.
Okay.
So I had all these books. A friend of mine said, I was with a friend of mine. She is a literary, I can never say that word. So I'll say wrong, agent, a book agent, basically. Mm-hmm. But she said she was with me and she was reading some of the stuff that I'd written. And she's like, wow, some of this is really good, Ali. And I was like, really? And she said, yes. And she said, who's publishing it? And I said, oh, I would never even thought about publishing. I just write for myself. I always write. I write poems. I write music. All right, books. Mm-hmm. And so she said, well, you should really put this together. Where's the rest of it? And I said, there is no rest. It's all like a pile of a lot of writing. And she said, can I take a look at it? And I said, sure. So she disappeared for about 3 to 4 months. And I thought nothing of it. But then, you know, a few months later, she's like, we need to talk. And I said, what is it? She's like, well, I gave a pile of the stuff to someone. They put a book together from a whole bunch of stuff that related to each other. And then, you know, one of the big five is looking to give you a contract, but for a series of the books because of, you know, the writing. And I was like, wow, okay, this is good. And let me tell you, it was a horrendous experience because I went there thinking they like what I said. And it was mostly about, you know, our environmental stewardship and how I believe it's a spiritual issue more than anything else. I mean, it's not economics, it's spiritual. I mean, you don't need to overconsume. You know, that whole overconsumption culture is a spiritual issue. It's something that's wrong here, you know, and here.
Yeah.
It's not something that has to do with the wallet, because if I don't use my Visa card today, they're not going to shut it down. I could have it and not use it for 3 years in a row. They're not going to close it. So there's no mandate legally that I have to go and shop. But here, something's wrong. So,
It's very similar to kicking an empty water bottle down the road, thinking someone else will pick it up. The spiritual aspect of that is, if it reached you, it was meant for you. And to pay attention to one's surroundings, because if each of us do it, it makes a difference. When we can excuse, well, the next guy will do it, or the cleaners will pick it up.
Right.
No, it reached you to test you. Perhaps, right? Everyone's got to prove that idea to themselves. But anyway, yes, continue. I love that concept.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, it takes away from your pointing fingers, too. You know, if you were to pick up the bottle, you wouldn't point your finger at who polluted, who threw the bottle, and why is the person who's supposed to clean it not picked it up already? What am I paying my taxes for? All these conversations go in the bin themselves with the bottle because, you know, you did it. And that's also one of the things, you know, one of the things I say about people when they, you know, on social media, other places, you see people attacking these corporations like Nestle. Oh, they make too much plastic. They're polluting the world. They're ending our world. Don't buy it. If you don't buy it, if you don't buy the Nestle plastic, Walmart's going to call Nestle and say, Nestle, please come pick up your plastic bottles because everybody's buying brand ABC's glass bottles now. You know, it's not Nestle's fault. Nestle is just responding to our demands. That's all it is. So it's our fault, you know? And so anyways, the publishing house turned around and said, well, you need to do a book tour and we need to print this many books and all that. And I said, hold on. This is about environmentalism and you know, understanding it from a spiritual perspective. How do you want me to jump in a plane and go from Chicago to New York to Miami to other places, you know, and Canada, trying to sell a book when I'm telling people to reduce their carbon footprint and I'm telling people to change their ways? One of the things I really don't want to do with this book is print, because I want it to be digital, to tell people, look, we did the same thing with newspapers. I remember when I was young, my dad, other people, they all had newspaper that they would read. And it was this huge document, right? As a child, it was so hard to learn how to flip through a newspaper. Like, it was always get crumbled. And so it's an art. You know, you feel like you became a man when you actually can flip through that paper, right? In my days. And so you're an adult now, Ali, right? And now I look around and I'm like, I can't for the life of me spot one person reading the paper in that way anymore. You know, with the espresso there and a cigarette, and those were that was the culture, you know, and now it doesn't exist. And we transition so easily. Everybody reads the news on their phones today. And, you know, it transitions so easily. Why can't we transition with other things that are, you know, detrimentally disastrous to our lives? And books was one of it. And so I explained this to them. They're like, yeah, you're right, but this is where the profit is. And I said, well, then why do you like my book? What is the interest? What appeal is there to my book when you tell me we want to pollute, and my book is saying do not pollute. You should want to kill me, not promote me. And so we had an argument. I said, no, I walked away. When I walked away, I said, okay, I walked away because I'm crazy. But there's a lot of sane people with families that they have to feed who are going to say, I need this job. I need this book published because our mortgage depends on this book. They are not in a position to fight the big five. They're not in a position to fight that $50, $100,000 million contract. So
true.
They have to take it. I thought, this is the place. This is what the universe is showing me. Start the publishing house. That's what I did. I started the publishing house. And so the first arm of the octopus was start the publishing house, get everybody who has the same kind of thought process to come here and leave them their rights. Because one of the things I found out, because I was never in the publishing world, I found out they take your book. They own it. You don't even own your book anymore. It's my writing. Yeah. I don't own it. I have no rights to it. They can do whatever they want to it. And I said, but it's mine. Yeah. And they don't understand the concept of it's mine. And so I said, you know what? In this publishing house, you as the author, this is your work. You hold on to it. We're just facilitating the spread of the beautiful work of art so that your mind can be spread around the world through this concept, you know, through this file, through this PDF. I can put your mind in every living room in the world that wants your mind in there. And that's the goal. That's what it should be. And so I started that. And then I thought, okay, to help the world, we need to have a foundation of some sort where we can tie the sales of this publishing house to the foundation to make the changes that we want to make in our collective when the collective grows. And so we registered a charity. And now the charity has 5 locations globally, you know, US, UK, Brazil, other places. And what we did after that is I thought, okay, I do music. And, you know, I love film, and there's many different avenues and mediums of art to express. I should expand into those. So we have, you know, love, which is L-O-V-E. It stands for language of emotion, but OV is written as O-V instead of O-F. And the idea of language of emotion is, I'm sure many people who are 20, 30 years old who are listening or watching won't remember this, but a lot of the older people will remember Live Aid in 1985 with Queen and all the other bands. That concert was free. If you watch the Queen documentary, actually, that was recent, a couple of years ago, I think it was, they make a point of inserting the part where Freddie Mercury has to fight to get stage time in that concert because they were late to the game. And so imagine the passion of an artist who's like, this is free. I'm taking my own flight there. I'm bringing my own band there. I'm bringing everything there. But I want to be a part of a movement. I want to be a part of change. My music is for change. So they show up and they have one of the best sets they've ever had in the history of Queen. And so many of the other ones too. And then what happens from that music, from that concert, who gets involved? Princess Diana. Because it was for AIDS, right? And Princess Diana's like, wow, this was really moving. This was touching. Okay, I want to get involved. What does she do? Later on, we find out, you know, she's at a hospital. She shakes hands with an AIDS victim. And basically, you know, the stigma breaks. People are like, oh, you don't get AIDS like that? Oh, you know, because I remember I was a child and my mom, when we went to Europe and the AIDS thing broke out in the early 80s, said, don't sit there. Don't touch this. Don't move it. Everybody was like that, right? Because we didn't know how it came. So music changed the world. It wasn't politics. It wasn't economics. It was not medicine even because medicine was doing its work, but it still could not reach the people. It was music that reached the people. And so I said, you know what? I want to revive that because when I see huge artists today who really are like the whole music industry of the 1980s can be placed into possibly one artist's reach today, someone like Taylor Swift, someone like Beyonce. And when you have people with that capacity and that reach, I want to build a space where people can come together and again, use music to make a difference. I remember I was in Toronto, I was living there when the SARS pandemic hit and the Rolling Stones came there and they had a SARS concert for us. And, you know, everybody loved it. It was beautiful. It was nice of them. People don't do that anymore. You know, like when Louisiana flooded, what, 2 decades ago or something, 3 decades ago, nobody showed up. I mean, there was nothing, you know, when so many tragedies happen, so many problems, so much poverty, so many wars happen. We're really not there anymore. Like the Bonos and those kind of people are not there anymore. We've become utterly capitalistic. And even through the agencies, maybe sometimes the artists want to help and the agent's like, no, the contract says I get 15%. So either you're paying me, somebody's paying me, or you're not going. And so the artists, they can't go. So Language of Emotion is designed for that, to bring amateur, A-list, whatever type of artists together to create these spaces where we can celebrate through music and really make a difference in the world. The art program and the kitchen program is very similar. It's a free kitchen with an experience center where we essentially show people how to eat locally and without animal cruelty. And so what we do here is we get local farmers to sponsor the project in the regions that we place the kitchen. And so because they're giving us the fruit and the food, we get local chefs to make the menu with what's available in the region. And this reduces our misunderstanding of our foods, because a lot of people have watermelon 12 months out of the year. And I explain to people, watermelon is not a winter fruit. You know, and the reason you have watermelon in New York in Whole Foods in December is only because of capitalism. It's not because it is healthy for you. The world created every food for us that we need for our bodies to be healthy. I'm not a doctor. Sure. I'm not a nutritionist, but I know enough that if I look at, you know, all the foods that come out of the earth, it's sufficient for me to be healthy. I don't need to take 20 extra pills to make that happen. And so we need to learn that. So we teach that while bringing in the issue of homelessness and, you know, animal shelters and animal problems in cities, in urban areas, in the developed world, mostly Europe and North America. And we try to make people live through this experience of understanding what that could be like and to bond people together. And so, you know, homeless people are welcome. The wealthiest people are welcome. Everybody can come. Everybody can join. We'll have a whole event every day. And this way people can get that experience and to bond and to make a difference, so that the next time you walk past somebody who is sitting on the side of the road, you don't just think automatically that that's a bum. That person is a life. That person has a story. You have no clue. If you would have even survived what they survived, that they're still alive and sitting there and hopeful to some extent to something, for something, or attached to something, that they're alive. You may have you know, had a heart attack and died going through the traumas that some of these people have. So we need to kind of, you know, relate to that and bring compassion. And so the other program is the film program. And with that, you know, right now, we have all these film fests and all these awards, and, you know, from the Oscars to others. You know, in the Oscars, we don't have a social impact compassion award for the movie with, you know, that really moved people, changed people, a documentary that made people get up and make a difference in their lives. Because it doesn't matter. Comedy matters. Action matters. Wardrobe matters. Those are the things that sound matters. Engineering matters. The music matters. Not that they don't. They do. And I love that artists are pushing every envelope, because look at the films we make today versus the 1920s. You know, it's all technology and pushing and innovation. I love that. I love it. But what happened to your heart along the way? Did you leave it back home? I mean, did we leave it 100 years back? Because, you know, where are those? Where's the championing of these kinds of movies? So Compassivi's film is about rewarding these type of films for people to come and say, I have a script. I'm a director. Mm-hmm. I have an idea. I have a friend of mine, you know, Alicer Munoz. I have another friend of mine, Sonia Rockwell. Both of them made autism movies, right? Self-funded in the sense that they had to go out and scrap and raise funds and make the films, the documentaries and the feature film. And, you know, you can't get those at MGM or Universal.
No. And, you know, in the 60s, I was just, I was born in 52. So in the 60s, I grew up. And I wanted, later on, it was in the 90s, late 90s, I wanted to make a documentary called A Walk Through the 60s. And I got some sample footage because there was so much activism. And that's the point I wanted to make, to encourage people that as you look back now, can you see all this activism finally did make a difference? Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King.
Yes.
The Kent State demonstrations against the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. The Burn the Bra, which was about women's freedom mm-hmm. and women's voice. And there were so many different protests.
Muhammad Ali.
A while. Muhammad Ali. I had Muhammad Ali in there. In the demo footage, and no one was interested, right? It wasn't of interest. And so because that, though, looking back, people could see it took a while. It would give people patience and strength and resilience and courage to stand their ground and continue to make the point, albeit, you know, hopefully peacefully, that like Martin Luther King. Or Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, there was footage in there. It wasn't from the 60s, but to make the point that Gandhi changed India mm-hmm. without one single shot fired. So that's a beautiful, I love that mission.
You know, that's the idea. And I keep saying that. I say, you know, Moses, I mean, Noah, these are, you know, whether you're religious or not, whether you believe or not, whether you think those are fables, it doesn't matter. The point is, Noah stood there and built this ark, metaphorically even, let's just say that, okay, to get everybody interested. Metaphorically, right. Noah built this ark and he brought all the animals and the people that he could and whatever and saved them. Okay, right. That was some form of activism because the whole community was like, you're psycho. And he's like, no, it's coming, you know, and that happened.
Yeah.
Moses, you know, if God came to me right now and he's like, you know, taps me on my shoulder, says, Ali, I say, yes. Oh, God. Okay. Hi. And he says, here's a staff, you know, go to Israel right now. And, you know, tell Hamas and Netanyahu, no more. I'm going to hit both of you with some disaster if you don't listen to me. Right. I would probably tell God, no, you know, go find some other, like, what are you talking about, this staff, right? Moses believed. He went and he walked all the way to Pharaoh, which was much more, at that moment, it was much more frightening than going to Netanyahu today. I would assume if I had to appear in front of Netanyahu today, it would be a more civil exchange because of the laws and the cameras and everything else. Back then, you know, it's like, chop his head, and that was it. And so he did that. He went there and he stood his ground. And now whatever the magic and everything else, whether you call it God or magic or however the story goes, he saved some people. These people, you know, were able to move. Jesus, Gandhi, Ali, Martin Luther King. You know, people dared.
They dared,
and there was no capitalism involved. And I, you know what? I always mention Martin Luther King with BLM. Right side by side. Yeah. And I mentioned them because Martin Luther King did not have the budget BLM had. Okay. But there was legislative changes. The laws changed because of Martin Luther King. Since George Floyd's death, show me one state with one law that has changed.
I don't know. You're right.
Nobody knows. You know why? Because the money was not purpose to the activism, because the activism was part capitalistic, because the activism was about, let me sell t-shirts, let me move to Malibu. And that's what happened, right? They're not Martin Luther Kings. Yes, right. these are not Martin Luther Kings. So when you say activate and become activists, we need to say it in the capacity of a mission with leadership and a goal. Today, we don't have leaders because the leaders get bought quickly, whether they're trade unions or whoever they may be. As soon as they become CEO, even in sports, you go into the NBA, the NHL, any of the sports, and as soon as, you know, the union people come to the top, somehow they're in bed with the owners of the team. Somehow they're in bed, like they're not representing the players anymore. And then the players have to go create their own association behind the association that's built for them originally, which doesn't make sense, right? The reason is everybody's bought easy. And so today what we need is strict goals. We need to say, okay, you know what? The George Floyd thing happened. You could say it was one cop. It was a bad cop and it happens. You know, we're almost 400 million people in the US. One guy this happened to, we need to let it go. Fine, I'll give you that. I'll even give you that. But show me what you're doing that will at least prevent this from happening again. God forbid it happens again. Just like the bridge that fell. Show me what you're doing that it happened once in the history of America, it happened that a ship hit a bridge and it fell. We shouldn't panic about it. Okay, fine. We won't panic about it. But show me how you're learning from it. If you can't show me that, I'm going to panic. I'm going to start panicking because I'm knowing now that my government is not representing my best interests. And that's what's happening in the world. So, you know, the music, the arts, the food, you know, the dialogues, the podcast, the books, the charity, and the society. That, you know, the conglomerate, basically all the people who join, you know, once this comes out, in a sense that people start realizing what we're trying to do and what the goal of this and what the mission of this is, it's essentially, hey, through these 8 different arms and gaming, of course, we have different aspects of gaming. All of these 8 different aspects, people can come in from any expressive space that they want. Once they get into
Ali, when you say gaming, you mean games that aren't killing people, video games that aren't killing people? You mean games
Okay, I'll give you a quick breakdown of the games. We have 2 kinds of games. One is essentially, both are environmentally structured. One is, imagine you go and stand into a virtual reality cube, okay, with 19 other people, 20 of you. Each of you has a smartphone. You get the app connected. And basically, when you enter, the whole screen will show you 1500s in your city. So wherever you are, whether you're in Chicago, London, you know, wherever, Nairobi, you pick, you're in the city. It will reposition you in 1500s of your city. It will ask you a series of questions. So basically, right now, you know, in the innovative times that you're in, you could go this way or that way. You could choose this or you could choose that. What would you choose? And you make those choices. Then the 1600s, then the 1700s. Each one is about 30 seconds of questions. Then you get to the 1800s. Then you get into, you know, the Industrial Revolution. And before that, you know, feudalism and the slavery and all of those things. Would you choose to have slavery? I mean, as an African in Africa, would you choose to sell your own people for money at that point, you know, with what you know now? Because that's part of it, too. I mean, you can't just blame, you know, the empire because somebody had to sell them to the empire. You know, we need to talk about that, too.
If you could meet your grandfather in America and you learned he had bought slaves, what would you tell him now?
Yes. And so, you know, is this.
I love that idea.
Yeah, it grows until today. And then basically it asks you questions based on your answer. So when you said, yeah, I want slavery, then you have racism issues in the future that it will start asking you about. But when you say, no, I will absolutely not, you know, interfere or be a part of that and whatever, then the future starts to change. And you see the world that you're not in anymore because that wasn't the choice we made. And you see that, you know, maybe world wars didn't happen and stuff. And so eventually it gets to the point where it goes from 2020 all the way to 2100, and it stops at 2100. By 2100, based on your choices, it's a realistic scientific measure of what the world in 2100 would look like. And some of it is scary. But when you see that and you think to yourself, I have a child who's 7 years old who will probably have a child who's 7 years old by then, that is an issue. That is an issue. It's I don't want to be a part of that. So that's one game. And then the results of all these games from different cities get compiled, and then we show the world which cities are at the forefront of making the better choices, which cities are really in tune with themselves, right? And we showcase that. So that's one part of it.
So how do we best support you? What is it that we can do as a community to support you?
As a community, this is what we're doing. We are going to ask people to be involved in our projects and be involved in them, not just financially, because there are people who can afford to give $100. There are people who can afford to give literally $1 million. And there are people who can't afford to give $1. Just because you can't afford to give, and we've re-scripted philanthropy or charity to only money, it doesn't mean you have no value. When you cannot give a dollar, you can participate. You can share the ideas. You can talk about it. You can change yourself through this ideology. You know, compassivism is all about, like you said, the nonviolent, compassionate activism. So the next time you're in a position to stand your ground, do so, be a compassivist, but don't be violent. But defend yourself and defend what you stand for, because that's how change happens. Change does not happen when, you know, you believe in something and you're trying to make a difference towards it and you educated yourself about it and you're making a stand like Rosa Parks did. And then the police show up and you say, okay, fine, I'll move from my seat. No, you stand your ground. That's nonviolent change. And that's how it happens. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we're not really doing that today, you know, because we have no purpose. We just go out for the flow of the stuff that happens. When people went out for the, you know, Black Lives Matter marches, I asked a lot of people, what is it that you're getting done here today in this protest? I mean, what law are you going again after? What are you asking for? You're here in front of your parliament. What is it? If, you know, if a member of parliament came out right now to the fence and said, hey guys, what are you doing here? What are you guys going to say? Who's your spokesperson? No organization. That was not Martin Luther King. And back then they didn't even have the tools to be as organized as we were. And they were, right? They were. Shame on us, But be involved, make that change, be a compassivist. That's the first level. The second level is support financially, because the truth is, for us to be able to make the changes that we want to make, we need the funding that we want to. But I don't want, and I've said this many times, I want smart money, not rich people money. And what I mean by that is, a billionaire may come and say, oh, I love what you're doing. I love this. I love the logo. It's amazing. You know, I'll sponsor this. I'll give you $200 million and, you know, put my banner right there with you. And I say, but no, but, you know, but you're half your money's in BlackRock. Like, how do you want me to work with you? Like, your money is sitting in HSBC. You have stocks in Aramco. You know, like, what do you want me to do with you, right? If you want to be a compassivist, don't give me the $200 million. Just move from those places and I'll be much more grateful to your services. So I don't want that kind of money. I want the money of the people who are making the difference, but who need to expand that. So the people who are saying, I'm going to read that digital book because I don't want to be part of the child slave labor of print books. I want to be a part of, you know, this movement because I don't want to be a part of that anymore. And I want to make that difference. Those kind of people, you're not going to make a change alone. You're doing the right thing, but you're not going to make that change alone, because one less book out of Amazon is not going to make a difference. But you and I and Steve and 20 million other Allies and Steves are and Sarah's, those are the powers that are going to come together. And Amazon's going to be like, oops, we're short an insane amount. Our market share, our problems, you know, you hit them where it hurts. And then, and it's not that they're evil. They're just supporting what we want. So make
that change. They might change as a result.
They will. No, it's not even they might. They have to. They have to, because they have to sell. Well, because I'll tell you something. Capitalists have no agenda other than profit. Okay? People make this, have this delusional idea that a capitalist has an ideology. A capitalist has no backbone. A capitalist says, I want the maximum amount of money, and that's all it is. That's what it comes down to, at any expense, which is why slavery happened. I mean, slavery, emotionally, slavery can't happen. From a humanitarian perspective, slavery can't happen. How do you do that to someone? It's impossible. But when you think about it, like, this is the cheapest way for labor, and I'm going to make the most profit. It makes absolute sense. And you do it. You know, eugenics, all these, even sciences came up with ideas that were capitalistic in nature, which is why they worked. They made sense because we value the dollar like God. So at this point, I tell people, don't worry about Amazon, because when nobody's buying print books from Amazon, Amazon's going to have the most innovative, perfect technology for digital. They're going to have the best readers. They're going to have the best color distributions. They're going to have a pop-up stuff on digital, because you know why? Because they have $5 billion to invest overnight to have the best book reader out. And because that calls for them. Apple will do it. Everybody will do it. But so long as we're sitting there and piling on the books, it's not their fault. We're asking them. So that's the second stage. The, you know, be a part of what we're doing. So when we, when Steve gives money, Ali gives money, Sarah gives money, then all of a sudden we have $30 instead of $10 each. $30 together has more power than $10 each. The goal is to raise that to an insane number. So, you know, I'm not looking at a million followers or being an influencer, none of that. I'm looking for raising 100 million people who say, okay, let's give this a shot. It doesn't hurt. It is. What's the worst that can happen? Let's give it a shot. I'll throw my $10 in here, just like a lottery ticket. Do you know how many people buy a lottery ticket for you guys to have a $1 billion Powerball? A lot of people are going against, you know, 7 million odds. I'm telling you, it's a 50-50 here. I either do it or I don't. I either buy a house in Malibu or I make the change. It's a 50% chance of either way, right? Because there's only two things I can do. You're at 50% odds. Throw me the money. Let me make difference. Let me make change. Let me make the programs and the plans, because we have an app that describes all the plans and programs that we're doing. Let me show you there what we can do with the money that we have. Once this flows and the wheel turns and you see the wheel going in the direction that you want, jump on the wagon. Then I want you to don't take the risk up front. So don't go, you know, picking your positions and risking yourself and your job, because these days, even in the freest countries, you know, if you have an opinion, you lose your job. I don't want you to do that. I don't want you to support capacity vocally. Just give me that $10. Let me do the work. Let me be the Jesus. Let me get crucified. I'll do that. Let me be the Martin Luther King. I'll do that. I don't want you to get hurt. But if I succeed like Gandhi and I did not become crucified, then at that point, you can stand behind me like the farmers did. That is all I'm asking people.
And then are there ways that we can support the books? You said you mentioned the digital publishing. Have authors?
We do.
How do we reach some of those books?
We have a few authors right now, and we have more in the pipeline, and we have book series coming out, and we have my books as well. So what we did is we decided not to sell them through our own publishing. We decided to sell them through Amazon. Only as digital. And the reason is we wanted to show people that you could use the same platforms. You don't need to boycott. You don't need to fight. You don't need to, you know, go and say, oh, these are the bad people. These are the devils. Amazon's. No, Amazon's offering a service. It's up to us to choose what service we want. I want to go on Amazon. It's my right to put my book on Amazon and to say, I only want it digitally. If every author chose that right, what would happen to the print books in Amazon? They would cease to exist. That is the goal that I'm trying to show, not to fight.
Well, Amazon. I'm glad you made me aware of that, because I think I have 9 or 10 books on Amazon now, but I have a couple in the works that I will do just digitally. And I have an Acorn and Oak children's book called A Tale of Potential, where we take the small-minded thinking, a child thinking, fear-based, and then develop into, you know, the standing next to the acorn is the oak, right? What's possible? What's the potential?
And if you want, and for publishing too, you know, you have your books. If you want,
digital.
We can publish it for you too. We're a traditional publishing house. We're not a vanity pub. We don't ask our authors for anything. We actually spend money.
Your mission. You know, I like the idea of just a digital, and you know. The universe has a way of reaching the people that you're meant to reach, right?
Always. I believe that very strongly. And I've seen that happen in my life. From the moment that I've started Compassivese, I've fallen on people who I've met in the most impossible of ways. And you would think that there are people on the team, literally, in a little town in Brazil, in Melbourne, Australia, in Montreal, Canada, in London, England, like scattered all over in Argentina, you know, scattered all over the world. And you would be shocked at how, you know, the universe just planted them in front of me and said, this is the person for this. You were looking for, I heard you were looking for a lawyer. Here, that's the lawyer.
So how do we find you? What's the website? You know, give us some ways to find you.
Compassivese.com is the website. So CompassiviseE.com. That's the website.
Compassivese,
And so what we have is we have tabs for every different department. So the Compassivese Publishing has its own tab, Compassivese Planet, Compassivese Foundation, and the different you know, causes we support and all of that. We have those. And it's all there. And then we have social media. I personally am not a big fan of social media, but I respect social media in the sense of the good that it can do. But unfortunately, you know, there's so much going on there in the competition to be able to be seen and to be able to say, hey, look, I'm doing something good here. I'd like people to join it. And there's so much like, you know, things going on there that, that are dark in a sense that I don't really enjoy. So we do have @com pacifist all across everywhere that you can see what we're doing. We post our stuff there as well. But really the best way to support is to get in touch as well. I like people to get in touch because, you know, when you donate money, it's also a kind of a distant relationship where, you know, you donate money, I send you an email, I say thank you very much, with a couple of flowers or something, and that's it. But when you say something, when you email us, when you talk to us, when you say something on our Instagram or somewhere, you're communicating, and we communicate back, and it builds something. You may have something that we can work with. You may have a cause that would really, really fit what we're trying to do, and we're like, we'd love to take that on, right? We'd love to work with you there. So I think that lost art of communication and reaching out to each other should be found, especially in this time when it's like that. You know, one email, press send, done. You know, one reply on Instagram or LinkedIn or something, done. You know, hey, Ali, I like what you're doing. This is what I'm doing. It's kind of similar. Let's collaborate. Lovely. Let's do it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that when you think about the mission, remembering how long it took for so many others to make a difference, and know with faith that this is going to make a difference, Ali. This is going to make a difference.
And I say, but I say it took no time at all. It took a day. You know why? Because when we look back at Martin Luther King, we cannot understand, or when, you know, we look back to South Africa, we cannot understand what it's like to sit in jail for 27 years until we can get up and start what we started 27 years ago over again. So we don't know how that feels. We don't know how long that takes because we're not living in that moment. We didn't we didn't go through the 27 years of waiting and saying, okay, when is this going to end? You know, when can we all be equal? We didn't do that. We're sitting here in his, you know, in the future, looking at history, and it's a moment because it's the paragraph that you read. That's all
back
it is.
It's a moment. Exactly. I agree.
And so when I'm living in it, I keep telling myself, it doesn't matter how much effort you have to put into it, Ali, because looking back, there will be a generation who will say, this took a moment, but look at what it's doing today. Jesus was a moment. Getting nailed on the cross was probably, the whole thing was probably 15 minutes, if that. But look at the impact. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about the business and the Catholic Church, but I'm talking about the golden rule, the impact, you know, the love that Jesus blessed the world with was done that way. And so, you know, that message, 15 minutes, the message in 15 minutes essentially is something that will never be forgotten for as long as there is some force of communication in the world. And so
thousands of years it's lasted.
Yeah, over 2,000 years, and we remember it.
I never thought about it like that, but it was probably 15 minutes, and it's lasted thousands of years.
Right, and there are people who have committed their entire lives to destruction and disaster that we don't remember anymore. We remember Saddam Hussein today. You know, we remember certain names because they were just recent history. But tell me the 1970s or 1980s, how many people, you can stop in the middle of the street, tell me, who was the worst person in the 80s? They'll be like, the 80s, I don't know, let me think about it. You see what I mean? But when you say, who is the worst person today? And the only name they'll remember is Hitler because, you know, it was huge. But that's it. But there were so many bad people along the same time as Hitler, supporting, helping, being a part of it. Other countries that defended him and supported him. It wasn't just Germany. Nobody remembers that. Nobody remembers Mussolini that much. So you see what I mean? Like we forget quick. But to see the impact of the names that pop up right away, you know, Mother Teresa. Recent, Jesus, old, but they pop up right away. That's the impact of the work of good work.
True.
That's compassion.
Right. So leave us with, as we get ready to close here, leave us with a thought and then remind everybody again how they can get in touch with you and support your work, etc.
Okay. I'll say how they can reach me first because I want people to remember the thought. That's more important than how to reach me. You can reach me on compassivist.com, on our social media handles, which are all across the board at compassivist.
And we will put that in the notes, by the way, too. We'll put that in the show notes. Perfect. So
that's that. And other than that, to leave people with a thought, I'll leave you with two thoughts. There is a thought that is wrongly ascribed to Socrates the philosopher. It was in Dan Millman quote of the character Socrates, in Dan Millman's book. And it, basically, the thought is, don't spend your energy fighting the old, but work on the new, because it's the new that will develop and make the difference. So to all the people who are sitting there and trying to fight the forces that they think they have to fight now, don't think of that. You know, if you're an environmentalist, for example, or an animal rights activist or all those things, don't try to fight the person, you know, who is skinning the animals for their fur. Actually, start changing people's mindsets to not want to buy the fur, which in turn will stop the trade. Because if you fight them, it's just going to get more gruesome, because they're going to find it more difficult to, you know, skin the animal. So it's going to become more brutal. That's all you're doing, because the trade will last. We've had all this activism and it hasn't stopped the fur trade. It's, you know, but the way we're reducing it is actually people are not doing it anymore. When a lot of people learn how it's gotten and a lot of people learn the, you know, the massacre of this trade, they started saying, I'm not buying fur anymore, whether they're the designer who's making it, whether they're the consumer. And so it changed. It's never attacking the person involved in it. So don't attack Nestle. Don't do these things. Find the ways that we can make the change to get this, you know, there. And the second thought is, we need to make compassion our first mental module, which means, this comes from Buddhism, and essentially, Buddha thought, you know, the mind works in modules. And I say it this way, so it's easy to understand. If a lion shows up in front of me, and I'm doing, and I'm bargaining with a shopkeeper to buy a pair of shoes and a discount, my mental module that's on then is my, you know, calculator, my economics module that's bargaining. I see the lion, that module is going to exit, and the fear module is going to go in to say, how are you going to get out of this and stay alive? Because there's no economics with the lion. So the modules change, and the favored module always takes over for every situation. Mm-hmm. In our world today, we have become so capitalistic that this constant capitalist module, this economic module of capitalism, has taken over most of our decision makings, whether it's purchasing something, whether it's investing somewhere, whether it's even having relationships with people. They've become opportunistic in nature. And so I say to myself, how is it that if I'm attracted to somebody and I want to date them, for example, how is it that the money aspect comes into play? Well, there has to be a materialistic module involved, because love is taken kind of like a second place there. We need to stop ourselves from doing that. Every time we want to take an action, if we put in our compassion, say, okay, before I order that, for example, coffee, let me put my compassion hat on. Let me think, where's the coffee coming from? How is this coffee made? What is this coffee really costing? What are my alternatives? Let me just purely think compassionately. Then make that action that you intend to make, you will make such a huge difference in your own life, and it will ripple communally into everybody's lives. So the thing I want to leave people with, which is really compassivist motto, love always, always love, is to always be in that module of love, which is the Jesus way. Whether you're religious or not, doesn't matter, you're Christian, Muslim, whatever you may be. He was a human being and he told people to love each other. That's all it is. That's all you need to know about Jesus. And for that, if you can be that way, there'll be no problems in the world.
Yep. Well, and I want to leave people with this thought that if you're listening this, remember something Muhammad said too, which was, what reaches you was never meant to miss you. And what misses you was never meant to reach you. And so if this reached you, there's a reason for this, and give it some thought. Even if it's not buying the Nestle water bottle instead of fighting Nestle, because Eckhart Tolle says, when you fight life, life fights you. And to Ali's point, don't buy it. Buy it in a glass bottle. Or don't buy it at all. Go home. Wait and go home and get a drink of water from your tap. But that's the activism that makes a difference. And that's been proven. That's been proven. And I just love your message. And I'm going to do everything I can to support you on my social media. And I'm sure we'll have a conversation later about some other things, because I'd love to find a way. I'm in New York City. I'm in Staten Island, New York. It's kind of, some people say it's not a borough of the city. It is a borough of the city. It doesn't look like New York City. And I can tell you that there's a way to make a difference around here, and I'm glad to do whatever I can to help. And that's part of my message. You've been listening to Different Thinking for Different Times, and what we talk about is stretching that small-minded thinking, like Ali's doing every day in his work, into limitless thinking, changing people's minds and then behaviors, changing their hearts and then behaviors. It'll make a difference. I'm grateful, Ali. Thank you for your message. And I'm grateful to everyone who's listened and will listen to this message. Take it to heart. Love the moment. Find a way to make a difference by loving those around you and changing what you're doing from small-minded to limitless. Ali, thank you.
Thank you. You said it best.
I'm grateful.